Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you this week? Welcome to September. Yay! I guess if you live up north, like I do, that means the end of summer. But it was a fun one, you know, a little hot, little climate changey, little pandemic-y, but I'm looking forward to fall. I really am. September, I think, is my favorite month of the whole year, followed closely by October. So hooray, happy about that. Today on the show, I have a really fun talk with Richard Biskovich, who is one of like my all-time baking heroes, really, really and truly. Going to talk more about Richard and then talk with Richard in a couple of minutes. And it's very exciting. He's a fellow that I've wanted to talk to since the very, very first days of the Rise Up podcast. And we finally pulled it together and had a chat. So I'm excited about that. So before I do that, though, just want to remind you, if you haven't joined Bakers for Bakers, it might be something that you want to do. So about a year ago, I started an online community called Bakers for Bakers. That's Bakers and the number 4 and then Bakers. And it's an online forum. It's an online community where bakers and bakery owners from around the world get together and have a chat and talk about questions and issues with their bakery and questions and issues about the craft of baking and that kind of a thing. In the last couple of weeks, there's been talk about, sharing tips and how do you do that with your staff. And there's been conversations about Quigamon and production processes and how long does it take you to sheet out and laminate a block of butter and a block of dough, that kind of stuff. It's fun and it's free. So all you have to do is head to bakersforbakers.org and sign up. And introduce yourself, and you're in. It's pretty easy. So head on over if you want to join a community of several hundred bakers from, you know, literally around the globe. That's the place to go, bakersforbakers.org. Well, that's what counts as an ad on this podcast. What's going on? Last weekend, to say farewell to summer, Cindy and I got on a ferry, and we headed over to Pender Island, to visit friend of the show, David Morton. David's, you might remember the chat I had with David a few months back. He's the solo baker behind Happy Monk Bakery on South Pender Island. And he does all of his baking and sales on Friday. So invited us out on Saturday, picked us up from the ferry, and introduced us to his lovely wife, Jennifer. And we went to his place. And got to check out the cob oven that he uses and gaze upon his mighty, mighty cookbook collection. Cool, because he's got the new Carolina Ground book from Jennifer Lapidus. Yeah, so I got to flip through that because I hadn't seen it yet. And it's certainly one that I've got to pick up for myself and dozens of others. It was kind of neat to go through and see his process and admire his stack of wood and all of that. And the lovely views out his kitchen window. He's a really interesting guy and a very gracious host. We had a fun day. He also took us to the Pender Island Farmers Market that was going on Saturday, which was a pile of fun. Big outdoor market at the community center and tons of tents set up and went around, bought a few things. David, being the local baker, is known by everybody. And so it was kind of cool to watch him say hello and have a chat with dozens of people as we made our way through the market. That was kind of fun. Isn't that a cool thing about being the baker in your community? You sure tend to meet a lot of people and have a lot of friends through the craft that we love. The other cool thing about the farmers market was that there was one fella, an older fella, a French pastry chef, had a huge table with all kinds of different pastries and desserts and beautiful, beautiful little items. And the biggest line I ever saw of folks waiting to get up and buy something. And so we didn't go in the line. We went through the whole market first and then thought, okay, at the end, okay, we'll get in the line now, which was a bit of a bad move because he was pretty much sold out of everything by the time we got to the front of the line. And there were like four little orange custard tarts and some sausage rolls. And that was kind of about it. Maybe like one cookie, that kind of thing. He was really getting right near the end. But there were still like a dozen people behind us in line. So I didn't want to buy everything. So I said, well, we'll take two of the orange custard tarts and give the rest, save the rest for the next person. And we picked up a couple sausage rolls. And he looked at me and says, man, you are so Canadian that you would like leave two for the people behind you. And I had a good laugh about that. I said, well, yeah, because who would take the last four tarts if you really didn't need four tarts, you know? Which kind of begs the question is like, is that something you would do? Would you take the last four when there's still a dozen people behind you in line? Seems odd to me. Seems you want to give everybody a little bite. Because you could I could already sense the tension of the people behind us. Like, is there going to be anything left? But I don't know that that's a Canadian thing. Maybe it's a baker thing. So that's my question of the week. Drop me a line at mark@riseuppod.com and let me know, are you the kind of person that would take the last four off the plate if you really only needed two to share with everybody? I'm guessing you wouldn't. All right, Richard Miskovich. So here's the thing. Right from the very first day that I had this idea for the Rise Up podcast, Richard was one of the folks I wanted to talk to because he was always really well known and talked about a lot through the Bread Bakers Guild and his teaching work at Johnson & Wales. But for me, it was his book, From the Wood-Fired Oven, that was a real game changer for me. It was a book that I read after I built my own brick oven, but his book really taught me how to use this thing that I had built and how to put it to good use, you know, over a wider spectrum of uses than simply baking bread. And he seemed like a really nice guy. And so when I went to Wheatstock in 2018, and this was just before the first episode of the podcast came out, I had actually, you know, had recording gear in my suitcase, and I took it with me to Wheatstock at Johnson & Wales, and Richard was one of the guys that I wanted to connect up with and talk to, and you know, I was just too darn nervous. He was busy because Johnson & Wales was the host of the whole event, and all of the teachers and instructors at Johnson & Wales were just running around taking care of business the whole weekend. And so I never even got a chance to corner him in a stairwell and introduce myself. And so we've played tag for the last couple of years trying to line up a talk and finally got to make it happen. And so I'm really glad that I get to share this with you now. So we're talking. I'm here in Victoria. Richard's at his home in Rhode Island, and we got on the Zoom and had a really good chat. So here we go. Richard Miskovich, who's a baker, an author, a teacher, and a real leader in the baking community in the United States, talking on the show. Here we go. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. What's that behind you?
That's some barley. I have a whole nother house next door to where I live. That's an Airbnb place, but I also set it up for teaching and being able to test baking. So,
oh, cool.
That's some barley that I grew last year.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. Good deal. That's lovely. Yeah. It's lovely. So, so this is this in Rhode Island?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm okay. Providence, yeah. Rhode Island. Well, I'm actually in Warwick. I'm just south of Providence. Yeah. You've been to Wheatstock. I'm about 10 minutes from campus.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I got to say, I loved your book so much. Even after I read it a few years after I'd built my oven, and then was instantly kicking myself that a lot of these materials weren't available when I was building my oven. But still, it was neat to see the progress, you know.
When did you build your oven?
2004, I think it was. Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, a lot happened in that ensuing decade. There was a lot that happened. And so none of us knew about those things, you know, so you were on the ground floor.
Yeah. 2004 was when I met Alan and took the workshop, and it was 2006 when I built it, but you know, same kind of thing. And it was like, that glass wool blanket idea was like, oh, okay, this is good stuff. We moved out to the coast before I ever had a chance to re-insulate the bottom of the oven. But I was always thinking I was going to get under there and add some more in. So wow. Yeah. Are you from Rhode Island, or whereabouts did you grow up?
So I grew up in Michigan.
Okay.
And then went to California. Mm-hmm. This is before my baking life. That was when I moved out there about 90 or so. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the coast of North Carolina in 95, 94. And that's where I built my first oven.
Okay.
And got involved with bread baking, and then moved up to Vermont and worked King Arthur for a couple of years. This was like 99 to 2002. And mm-hmm. then I came to Rhode Island and love it. You know, it suits me well.
Okay.
I'm lucky to be here.
What's about it that suits you?
It's I like the sense of being in this small state. Right. You know? My girlfriend grew up in Rhode Island, and so it's good to know the stories about Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. It's close to the ocean.
Yeah.
It's close to New York City. It's close to Boston. It's close to Vermont. I can be to King Arthur, which I go out there a couple times a year. It's only 3 hours, right?
Oh, okay.
You can be in a completely different bioregion in three hours. And it's quirky. You know, the architecture is pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's a good food scene. Because the state itself is small, in some ways it's easy to have change happen if you think about food policy and stuff that can happen within the state. Even though it's a diverse state, it's not the size of Saskatchewan. You know,
you have your own
challenges with bringing those different people together. Yeah. Even if you think about growing food, we're all basically right smack dab in the same situation.
Yes, so, totally.
So it's easy. It's it unifies the experience for people who live here.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I hear what you're saying, because even, you know, Saskatchewan doesn't have a lot of people, but with all of that space, you've got completely different regions, you know, everything from, you know, forestry and mining in the north to, you know, farming in the, like grain farming in the middle to more ranching in the south and the west. And right. it's different, you know, it is for sure. Yeah. Well, and so what was your pre-baking thing? Like what were you into first before you got into baking?
I was always interested in food. Both my parents cooked a lot, and I had a good role model as my father, as someone who cooked. And then even when I was in college in the 80s, I got a job in a grocery store in a proof and bake bakery.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, when we look back and think about it now, it was, you know, it's not great stuff, but it introduced me to the process and the method. Mm-hmm. Not the method like we know it now, but the hours, I like those hours. And so I did that, but left that. And then, you know, again, got lucky, just started baking at home in the early 90s, right when all these people that we admire so much came together and formed the guild. And the cultural change happened, that I was able to catch the wave and learn from all these great people. And then I didn't intend to do that. It just happened.
Yeah, sure. So was it kind of King Arthur the central point for you around that time, or what?
No, so I was living on the coast of North Carolina, and which was very and still is kind of remote, but the world has changed since then. But very rural,
yeah.
And my wife at the time bought me a copy of Dan Lehner's book Bread Alone, which was one of the early ones, right?
Sure.
And because I had been interested in baking at home, mm-hmm. and we'd moved from California to North Carolina, and had the time in a way to explore different types of food systems and making food. And so Dan Lehner's book was my introduction, where I had been baking bread from American style recipes before that.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's anything bad about that, but a lot of yeast, warm dough temps, not a lot of control over fermentation. And then Dan Lehner's book, Bread Alone, was this revelation to me of like how I could make that bread, which I always was interested in, old world type breads. I mentioned I grew up in Michigan in the 70s, but I did have relatives and they would bring Polish baked goods. So I had some tiny connection or like a familiarity with old world breads.
You know? Yeah.
So then I just started doing that, you know, keeping a sourdough starter and that way. And then I just really got interested in it and found, and in the back of that book was the Bread Bakers Guild of America.
At yep.
that time was in Versailles, Pennsylvania. And I called and I said, I'm looking to learn more. And said, oh, this place just opened up called San Francisco Baking Institute. And everything just fell into place. I'm like, wow. Called them. I'm like, yeah, we're having a class in a couple of, I don't know, 2 months yeah. or whatever. And then I found out about Alan Scott. And at the same time, I went to visit him. And so it was just like as it might have been foreseen,
yep.
Because of the work of a lot of people, I have these resources at hand.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm be forever grateful.
Yeah. No, that's so cool because it's you know, I got into it probably 10 years later, but it's a very similar path. It was just more, everything's more established, you know, because, Dan's book, the fact that he was a darn good storyteller in addition to all the recipes. Like there were a few books that out around that same time that it was like, I read cover to cover, but I spent more time between the recipes than within them, if that makes right. sense, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, no.
Amy Sherber's book was the same way. I was, you know, it's all every sidebar, even Jeffrey's book. It was like, I was reading the sidebars. I'm reading the stories. I'm kind of, you know, anytime that they would spend time sharing the rhythms of the bakery or, you know, what a day is like or that kind of a thing. I was just soaking that all in, you know, but yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was an amazing time in the American bread renaissance where like I read Dan's book, but then I, mm-hmm. when I went to SFBI, you know, Lionel Vachonnet, who I know you're a fan of too.
Yeah.
You know, he's my first teacher ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had two consecutive weeks, you know. And yeah. then I went actually to Alan Scott's house and Chad Robertson was baking there.
He was, eh?
You yeah. know, it was just like this great, great time
yeah.
that did combine the stories of bread baking.
Yep.
And I just was lucky enough to read Dan's stories of bread baking. Yep. And I didn't have the opportunity to take a class with him. And then I met Lionel, who taught me how to calculate water temperature,
right? You
know?
Yeah,
and then I met Alan Scott, you know, this wizard who was doing this whole other thing. And again, I when we look back on those times, and not that it's not still a lot of innovation, but I feel super lucky to have met those
yeah
people and those men and women who, you know, really impacted the foundations of
yeah
bread baking.
Yeah. Well, cause it was a quantum leap, right? Like, you know, like the, in knowledge transfer and stuff back then, that's how I felt anyways. Like, so I haven't met Lionel yet, but when I went to SFBI, I spent a week with Didier and that for me was just like, okay, I'm now experiencing a whole other level that I didn't know was possible before, right? Just spending time with him and how he saw things, you know, and it's so cool. And I know it still happens for folks, but it, I don't know it. Well, and it's probably just more a reflection of my own time in it that, I don't get the quantum leaps anymore. I'm learning all the time. And my gaps in knowledge keep growing, not shrinking. But
right, yeah,
it's sort of like I don't feel like I'm going, you know, 100 miles an hour in my learning. Right. Yeah.
Well, the more you know, the more you know how much you don't know.
Exactly. Right? Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But Mark, I think an interesting thing about that time too is that not only did it inform the professional bakers and home bakers, anyone mm-hmm. interested in artisan baking, but it began to affect the food culture of this country, of this continent,
yeah,
and of the world, really. You know, mm-hmm. we think about global participation in what we have begun to call the artisan bread industry,
yeah,
the world. You know, like, who knew? People are so cognizant, and when I say people, I mean just like the great unwashed mm-hmm. of these different types of baked goods,
yeah,
that they're available to them in differing levels of quality, and
right.
You know, we want to be able to have gateway breads that introduce people, and we want to have hardcore breads that mm-hmm. People can embrace too, and think this is so super cool. But you know, we've undergone such a massive cultural foodscape change, and the bread world was part of that.
You're exactly right. I think that was the time that it went from that sort of hardcore, nobody knows about this, like you really got to seek it out, to it's not quite mainstream yet, but it's a much wider, a much broader group of people are seeking out the good stuff now that just wasn't around back in the 90s.
I would argue that some things are mainstream. And of course, as the message increases, mm-hmm. Croissants, for instance, or Queen Amon, you know,
yeah,
when as oppression goes up, it doesn't have to be the way, but quality tends to go down. But if you look at, you know, a low denominator of fast food, and there's a Chris sandwich.
Yeah, that's true. That's,
you know, if people were told have Burger King put out a Chris sandwich in 1975, and people are like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true.
You know, same with brioche, even a mainstream burger joint and have a brioche bun, you know, 30 years ago, people would know what that means. So it's a sign of the times.
Yeah. Pretzel buns, I guess it'd be in the same vein, right? Like it's, you can
totally,
you can get something called a pretzel bun anywhere. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Good
right.
point.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So how did from the education to actually getting involved in baking for yourself, did you ever, like, were you running your own place? Or were you working in bakeries, that kind of thing, or were you just kind of doing it on your own in those early days?
So after I made that trip to California, I was living in North Carolina.
Right.
I went to SFBI, San Francisco Baking Institute, and met Alan Scott and bought, you know, what was a Xerox set of
yep.
plans.
Yep.
My former wife and I had just bought property on the coast of North Carolina, and I just learned how to bake, and I just met this oven builder, and I was like, I'm going to make a backyard oven, which ended up being bigger than I anticipated. And yeah, so for a couple of years, I had a very small micro bakery.
Right.
And it was a great time to learn. It was a dynamic time in, you know, this exchange of ideas with going to what the bread makers used to have RBA shows and be in Atlantic City.
Right.
And we're kind of part of that larger industrial baking scene, but a lot of exchange of ideas, and organic were becoming more of a reliable food source. The supply chain was evolving, and I was lucky enough to I got a job making bread for a restaurant that had wood-fired oven. So that's when the wood-fired oven scene also entered.
Okay,
you know, kind of, and we can see how that is. That's a Venn diagram now between wood-fired baking and wood-fired, not high-end necessarily, but restaurants that have wood-fired oven or apps and this culinary technique that produces really tasty food and is also draws people through, you know, through the magic of fire making food. So I got a job in a restaurant like that.
Okay.
And then built my oven and really kind of practiced the process of bread baking, you know.
Okay.
Trying to control fermentation. You know, I didn't know it much. and it was hot and all that type of stuff. And the vagaries of the wood-fired oven and all of that. Very exciting and a good crucible to learn.
Sure.
And so that was really my only self-owned bakery experience, which didn't last that long, but was a good learning experience. And then I went up to Vermont, started working at the King Arthur Flour Bakery for a couple of years.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And then how did the path of teaching kind of weave into this?
So again, was lucky, and I went to King Arthur not long after the bakery was established, and was lucky to work, you know, with Jeffrey Hamelman, and the idea of that facility, which was born from the minds of Frank and Brenna Sands, was that it would be a bakery and an education center, right? And this fully went in line with what was happening at that time. Mm-hmm. So at that time, which would again been about 99, there was a production bakery and there was also an education center where there might be home baker classes, but also Jeffrey would teach week long professional classes.
Right.
And they would actually be in the bakery when we might be cleaning up or finishing. And I had the wonderful opportunity to just work with Jeffrey. And so there was always this education aspect of King Arthur from the beginning of the bakery.
Right.
And previous to that, it had been a flour company, and they had gone and diversified and had, you know, and books when, you know, people used to sell books in stores and stuff like that.
Right.
And, but the idea, the germ of the idea was always to have it be an educational facility. And so I just kind of, after a while, was able to start teaching some small classes and realized that was a really wonderful way to interact with people. You know, bread baking brings together everybody, whether it doesn't matter what their political leaning are, sexuality is, socioeconomic status is, gender, race, any, all of that goes away because everyone's interested in having good bread. And so I just was able to engage with that energy, which was cool. And then again, I got lucky and there was an opportunity at Johnson Wales and I just moved here and started teaching full time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So just sort of, cut your teeth at King Arthur and then came over. That's cool.
Right.
Yeah. And when did you come to Johnson and Wales?
I think I'm starting my 19th year this fall.
Wow. Wow. Good for you.
Yeah. Thank you.
And so then the Johnson and Wales program and curriculum and stuff, I'm curious sort of what's your role there now? What's a year look like for you as a teacher there?
So I'll start with my role. So I'm a department chair of the baking and pastry department. I share that with another woman, and I've been doing that for 4 years. So I don't teach as much, but help support students and faculty. And it's interesting learning how those educational opportunities evolve. Previous to that, and I'm sure at some point in the future, I'll return to full-time teaching. which is an amazing experience because we have 6 hour long classes. Mm-hmm. We, you know, the bread bakers, of course, say, oh, this class should be 10 hours long, but that doesn't work out so well. But we still have pretty long lab classes, 4 days a week, 4 days a week. And our primary demographic are college age students.
Right.
And they're getting a degree. So they also take academic classes and have degree progress, and they live in dorms. And I get to have the opportunity to work with these people who are super interested in all aspects of the food industry.
Right.
Which could be baking a pastry, and they might be like super into making cakes. They really might be into plated desserts. They're total breadheads, right? They kind of self-select. Mm-hmm. And then also culinarians, young chefs who want to cook, want beverage people, nutrition people. So it's a very dynamic environment. We have, like I said, 6 hour lab classes and you spend, several weeks with people and get to know them. And they are very anxious to learn, interested to learn.
Yeah.
And again, I'll refer back to what we spoke about earlier. Like I went to SFBI and, there were a couple people because it was a young program and learned from Lionel, and my brain was on fire, right? I'm like,
yeah,
this is the coolest thing. Not that we're not jaded, that we don't still think that's cool, but that initial experience has a lot of power.
Yeah.
And so I get to work with these people who are like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And it is, they learn amazing things. And yeah. We have a 2 year and a 4 year program. They can get a bachelor's degree in baking and pastry arts and cost control and sanitation and nutrition and beverage. Yeah. And then I get to work with people who have, if I need to have a pig butchered at my, in a couple of weeks, I know they got a call, right?
If
I need a wedding cake, I know they got a call. And so it's also a very interesting faculty and staff. So
yeah,
again, I'm lucky and grateful to have that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I often wonder about that because I talk to a lot of folks, well, a whole range of people, I guess, is the joy that I get to have, with the podcast and that. But I always find the folks that are on the more formal education side of things, it's the breadth of what you're teaching is really helpful. Like you say, understanding food safety, understanding cost control, understanding production or how you might set that up and those kinds of things. It's really valuable in addition to the practical teaching and practice of the craft, right?
Right. Yeah.
When we had our retail bakery, had a lot of different staff come through, and I was lucky to have one pastry arts graduate come from school to come and then work with us for 3 years, and the difference was amazing. Just sort of the breadth of what mm-hmm. she had experienced, even a little lab, or we did this for a week, or we did this for 2 weeks, but it just even exposure to it
mm-hmm.
Made for a lot different conversations at the bakery, and it was good.
I'm glad to say that. There are two things I would like to say about that demographic, and you said when you communicated with me, okay, if there's something you want to talk about,
yeah.
So, and I'm biased here, right? Because
sure.
This is where I work with
sure.
young people like that. But, what I hear a lot about, and I'll just use the term culinary school graduates, is that, they're cocky and they don't show up and all that type of stuff. And that they want to come in and change everything. And I think that is true. I think there's a lot of overly confident people. Mm-hmm. But I would say that most of us, when we were 22, we're overly confident, and I don't think it's specific to the culinary school demographic.
Nope.
I like on my list are to like contact the, American Plumbing Association Guild and the, American Electrician Guild and say, when you have you know, apprentices that come through of, we have New England Tech here, right? It's like a 9-month program, and that, you know, you can become, enter because you have to get certified to be an electrician. You know, do they think they're like super the best electrician in the world? And I bet they do. and because that's what we want young people to be confident that way, you know? So when I hear that, I think, okay, well, let's listen to what they have to say. Maybe they do have a better idea, even if they are not that experienced yet with being able to express that in a way that other people can absorb. And right. And the other thing, again, about this group of people is that they are, I work with young people and they have lives and they have responsibilities. And when I hear about, you know, millennials, or they're always on their phones, or, you know, they don't, you know, they're not attentive, or mm-hmm. I think, you know, they, I go to work at, you know, sometimes and always 6 o'clock in the morning. Our classes start at 7 o'clock in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of 18 and 19 year old people. They're lined up waiting to get into class, and they're super chipper and respectful, and they work hard. I mean, not all of them, but, you know,
yeah,
not all of any age group does. And they get a bad rap, you know, that generation gets a bad rap. And it just reminds me of that Bob Marley song, "You Can't Blame the Youth," right? I mean, like, part of what I'm trying to say when I get a chance is that we should give these people a chance to do well, because right. they're benefiting from all of the bread baking knowledge that has been accumulated and that people have worked for and on.
Yeah.
And, you know, the coolest thing is to see graduates from 10 or 12 years ago who are really doing a great job in the bread baking world, whether it's someone owning their own bagel bakery in Sonoma, whether it's the head bread baker at Facebook, whether it's former students who are on the board of the Bread Bakers Guild of America. You know, it takes a while, and we just need to remember to share with them as generously as the people in 94, 95, 96, 97 share with us, hopefully without judgment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, but you raised a really good point, though, because you're training people, or you're teaching people for a career in this food industry, as opposed to, you know, because they're making a big investment. It's not like, well, this is a job that I'm going to do for a while before I go start my real career. Like they're trying to find their way in this industry. And even with some of the examples that you gave, you mentioned in one sentence, a couple opportunities that I'd never even considered in the food world, right? Like head of bread at Facebook or whatever it happens to be. And that broadening of perspectives is valuable as well, right? To say like, this is the whole spectrum of the industry here that you can be part of as you find your way and find the fit for you, kind of a thing. As opposed to hiring somebody and say, well, I'm going to train them up myself, but I'm training them for the world of my retail bakery, plain and simple. I don't have it. The breadth to expose them to the wider world. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. That's a great point. It's true. Our students get to see a very broad, spectrum of possibilities.
Yeah.
I was also going to say some of those people don't make it in the industry, and that's all right. You know, just like all of us have convoluted paths.
And
you start out in something, you're like, this isn't quite right for me. That doesn't mean you weren't going to be successful. That doesn't mean that doing that work was not valuable.
Yep.
That just means it wasn't a good fit.
Yeah.
And what I think is, when I see some of these people do different things, sometimes it's slightly food oriented, sometimes it's not. But I think, you know what? That person knows what it means to work in a bakery because they've done it, right? Like,
yeah,
they might have said, you know what, this is not for me. but they have gratitude, hopefully, and an appreciation for what it does take to create things. And I think, you know, this greater awareness of food is something we should all work on and tie it through the whole chain of production, from growing it to producing it. And a really interesting example, I think, there's an organization called the Northeast Grain Growers Alliance here in New England, of course.
Okay.
And so one of the campaigns that we're doing is we're trying to tie square footage of grain production to particular products.
Okay.
And doing that visually. So I won't put you on the spot, but and it differs for the alcohol level of a beer.
Right.
But for a pint of beer, it's about 4 square feet of barley that needs to be grown.
Okay.
For that one pint of beer.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a huge amount of land.
Yeah.
And someone to prepare that land, grow that crop, harvest that crop, have it be made into beer. Also, someone else is, you know, shepherding it through that process, packaging it, selling it, and having someone be able to afford it. And then they like, when's the last time you sat at a bar and put down a pint of beer?
Yeah. Well,
maybe not sat at a bar.
Yeah. No, but
because
I agree.
COVID. But you know, when's the last time you drank that much beer and thought, okay, that's a raised bed size, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think is an interesting thing for the future, is how we can make this connection. And again, these people who might go through culinary school and not do it as a career think, okay, I know how much prep went into making that pizza.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Especially with you know, what does food cost, or how much are you paying for, you know, I'm sitting at the bar and how much do you want for that beer? You know, and it's like that seems expensive until you start counting it back a bit and say, well, hold on, maybe that's actually cheap, you know, for all of the inputs that went into that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, and like I've been reading about that a lot more, just about, you know, meat production and sort of that, do that same calculation for the burger that you're eating. And it's even scarier, which is pretty eye-opening, but you're dead on. Like those connections, you know, my grandparents were grain farmers, and my dad did that later in life as well. Right. And so he kind of realized, like, you know, they're not making very much for what gets produced out of what gets produced downstream, for sure, you know. And that's something there's got to be a bit of a shift, you know. I just want to circle back to what you're saying about, you know, the criticism of millennials and stuff, and because I would be a Gen Xer, I believe, but as you were telling that story, I just went back to when I was 23, started my first day, you know, after I got my CS degree, my computer science degree, and went to work. And I was like, yeah, you're darn right. I thought I knew what I was doing. You know,
sure.
it's like you look around and you go like, why are you doing everything like this? But I think the folks doing the judging now are just further removed from being 23. and so they forget what they were like, you know?
And it's a generational problem. If you go back 500 years, like, I can't believe they're doing that.
Yeah, those kids today,
younger,
with their plows. Yeah.
but again, to bring that back to the bread baking world,
mm-hmm.
these are the people who have learned the foundations, who do think about different ways of doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we definitely see we're at a point in the artisan bread industry where, you know, the torch is being passed, and that's great.
Yeah.
And we have to do that. And that's another wonderful thing about teaching at Johnson Wales. One of our bachelor level classes is come up with an idea. And sometimes I come up with ideas and I'm like, that is going to be a disaster. You know, like, no way. And then they do it. And I'm like, you know what? That's not that bad. So So let's apply some techniques, or, you know, maybe I can help you out with that. And I'm like, you know, I wouldn't have thought of that. And that's, we shouldn't, that's the age old struggle between tradition and innovation.
Absolutely. It's cool that you've got the, that you've sort of by design got that environment to do that experimenting and give it a try in a semi-controlled way.
Yeah.
Well, and you would expect 99% of the stuff to not work, but that 1% is going to be pretty awesome. So, you know, and it's one thing to say it, it's another thing to actually set up the place to work like that, you know, or set up a class to work like that. Yeah. I'm really keen to ask now, what else is on your list of things that you want to make sure we talk about? Cause, I loved this last one.
I think, you know, just kind of going back to basics, and I know you have your, starting this too, is just, you know, wood-fired ovens.
Yeah.
Always been excited about that, but I'm looking forward to helping rebuild a community oven in Norwich, Vermont by King Arthur.
Uh-huh.
And also maybe building another one here at my house. But, you know, just, you know, what you think, cause you speak to so many people, and again, it's kind of charting the progress of the evolution is, you know, how interesting it is, you know, your perceptions on how interesting it is that so many people have them in their backyards now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Compared to back when you might've taken that class with Alan Scott. You
know, totally.
And what you make of that.
Yeah. Well, it's, well, I'm finding a couple of things, like certainly the, like pizza's the gateway for sure. You know, and I think, you know, I talked with a fellow that works for those, the Uni ovens, right? So not brick ovens, the portable things, but they're like a little rocket stove. And, But the number of people that I'm seeing that aren't in the food world that have bought an Uni oven, and, you know, I see it up on Instagram, and they're making pizzas, and they're making their own food, and they're making it excellently in this little portable thing. I think that's the gateway in for a lot of folks that, you know, because these Alan Scott ovens, like we have, you know, you're kind of making them for bread. I think the folks that make them for pizza are kind of disappointed by the just amount of mass that they've got to deal with, you know, but like even in this last year, you know, folks that it's like, well, I got started with a cob oven, you know, and then a cob with a brick hearth. And now I'm thinking of upgrading and stuff, and just seeing that it's kind of like, I want to go back in time and then bring it forward, you know? So back in time, so I'm going to use, you know, quote, old technology to make this thing go and really kind of learn it and understand it. And then I'm going to start bringing it forward more has been interesting to see. The one that's blown my mind, because I had no, until I started talking to people through the podcast, I had no idea of these Rothco ovens that home bakers are growing up to. You know, sort of so I'm going to get a stone hearth. I'm going to be able to do like 9-10 loaves at a time, and I'm going to make a little micro business out of it. That's blowing my mind, because I didn't even know they existed until about a year and a half ago.
Right.
But I think the brick oven folks that I'm talking to, it's where I think you helped a lot of folks. And because I've talked with a few folks that have said, you know, so I got my start kind of like you. Mine was the brick oven list. And then I met Alan for a workshop, and then I got the Xerox plans, and then I built my own, right? You know, and whenever you got those plans from Alan, there was just more pages on top. Like there was really like three versions all bound, given to you in one envelope, but you made
with
it
with handwritten notes.
Yep. And he would sent me via email some hand-drawn like PDFs of some details that I didn't understand, you know, and he would sketch them out and, you know, that kind of thing. It was brilliant, you know, but, when your book came out, I honestly think that the second half of your book, when you were like, okay, from oven management to what am I going to do with this oven through all the heat cycles? That was another step, you know, that was another step in knowledge and a change in how we think about these things. Cause it wasn't, how do I build it to hold it in bread baking temps for as long as possible? and then I'm done. And then it's all just kind of wasted on the sides. Certainly when I read your book, it was like, I was just pinging with all these ideas of what can I do on the shoulders of that? What can I do on the way up as I'm heating it? What can I do on the way down? And that was a real game changer for me in how I thought of using the oven. And it became this much more versatile thing in my backyard.
Yeah. And I think it depends that idea of riding the heat wave, the cooling curve applies both to residential and commercial, but in a lot of ways, residentially, there's more versatility because in a commercial application, the oven doesn't get that cool sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And, for sure.
So it is, you know, a fun thing to think about and an evolution. I think that was the thing for a while. It was just bread and pizza.
Yeah.
And it really was after I got my job at Johnson & Wales and had a teaching break in the summertime, like I'm grateful for to be on right now. When I went back to North Carolina and I realized, oh, that oven had more versatility than when I was just baking year round.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not like it's better or worse. It's just, it's a different, it's a cycle that can be used by a residential brick oven baker more than a commercial oven baker.
Yeah.
But there's still lots of other stuff out there on the shoulders.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, because when we closed our retail bakery in 2015, I went back to the brick oven in my backyard and I was baking bread on Friday and Saturday for folks on former customers and that. And then it would cool down and start on Tuesday, kind of firing it up again for the next weekend. And so that's a pretty inefficient schedule to bake 2 days a week and then just let it cool off. But, you know, we started, you know, we're going to have grill night on Thursday night before the bake where, you know, the oven's firing and away you go, but we'll pull some stuff up and, you know, stack some fire bricks up and put a grill on top and away we go. And we're cooking supper that way.
Yeah.
And then Saturday night, like every Saturday, I could have sold so many roast chickens out of that oven after the fact, because we were doing our own, we were putting our own in the oven, you know, right. As people are coming to pick up bread and it's like, what is that smell? What are you doing? It's like, oh, sorry, right. I'm making my supper here.
Right. And you can't have any. But I know. And that's an interesting thing too, I think, you know, because the bread baking window in wood-fired oven use is pretty narrow and pretty, you know, not wonky, but it's a, you know, you have to be fuss budgety, right? You have
yes,
to seam
yeah.
and all that type of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I in no way mean to denigrate the culinary profession, but cooking with fire is easier than baking in a wood-fired oven.
Yeah.
Especially with biologically raised doughs that need to have steam and the proper temperature and a long baking time, right?
Yes.
And so I think that's a huge, you know, way for people to embrace that. You know?
Yeah.
It's so great and delicious.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to Alan's original dream from the Bread Builders book. And that was the story that got me hooked at the start was, you know, he would bake his loaves, you know, for 50 people around town and go and deliver them. And then while the oven was cooling down, would cook all this food for the week, you know, it's kind of thing. And I think in Alan's case, it was a lot of baked beans and stuff and that's fine. And you helped me break open my imagination on what you could do on those cool downs, but I'm going to say it's a romantic story, but not in a fanciful way, but in a, this would be a fulfilling way to do it.
It's romantic in a certain way, but it's also very feasible. I mean,
yes.
What did people do a couple hundred years ago?
Totally.
That's what they had.
Yeah.
And that's what you used. And it was great. I mean, think about just the evolution of wood-fired ovens in kitchens, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Probably a huge, a hugely convenient. And now we look at that and think, oh man, that would be a pain to have that little, those little irons that you pull off. You know, and that little side baking box and stuff, which is cool, but it's tough.
Yeah.
But that's what people had, and that's how they prepared food.
Yeah.
And, and for us to have that technology now, it just in a way goes the opposite and provides a lot of different opportunities that we don't have our own kitchens, because you contain live fire.
Yeah.
And that, and that's a magical thing to cook with.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you experienced any sort of return or springing up of more of a communal oven kind of model? You know, like that's always what I read about in the past was, you know, a village in the center of town. And when I traveled to Europe, you'd see some of those like in the center of a neighborhood. Have you seen any modern versions?
I think there was definitely a good trend, but guess what interrupted that would be COVID.
Yeah.
But I know that, and again, if we had a map of community ovens in North America, you know, 1990 compared to now, I'm sure it would be a completely different map. Mm-hmm. But I think, I'll do a community oven building lead a class in Norwich, Vermont in a couple of weeks.
Right.
I know Johnson, Vermont, they have a community oven. I'll speak to that model because it is in their town square.
Oh, cool.
Classic Vermont, you know, green. And I think the city kind of does the administration on it. And they have, you know, each night, each Monday night of each week, they might have a pizza night. And I think in the right environment, it catches on. And I think it might be partly due to the neighborhood size or the community size. But I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't come back, although we have to see what the effects of what people gathering together will be like on the next generation, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
People might be like, you know what? I'll just build one in my backyard. We just got ingrained in ourselves. We got ingrained in ourselves to not gather.
Yeah.
So community gathering right now is kind of a tough sell.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm curious to see how long that lingers, you know, sort of like that would be certainly an unplanned or unanticipated side effect of all of this craziness is just what is the delay before people start embracing the model of we can do this all together and do it
right.
Once. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would say it's pretty intoxicating, you know, the community oven. The advantages or the draws of that, there's fire, there's food, there's community.
Yep.
That might draw people to gather more so than, you know, going to a concert or,
you
know, feeling like they can go eat out at a restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotcha. And so fun for you outside of work, is it these summer classes that you're teaching or what else do you have on the go?
I do that, but I also, you know, I'm an avid gardener. I do like growing grains, and I am fortunate to have a fairly big chunk of property.
Oh, nice.
With two lots. So I'm able, you know, I appreciate being able to like nurture the land and steward the land. I have an additional piece of, you know, structure that is I can teach in or do product development, and I can have it as an Airbnb location. So I work on doing that. So it's kind of just taking care of my land and being able to, you know, have that, you know, period. It's so great. And I'm grateful again for a teaching job where I can kind of do some different things and do outside teaching and grow different things.
Yeah.
You know, receive guests here and have the time to focus on growing grain and growing things and baking stuff that I'm interested in.
Good for you. And is the fall semester at Johnson and Wales, is it going to be kind of back to normal or are you still, what are you thinking in terms of COVID restrictions and that?
The university has, you know, released differences. Mm-hmm. you know, it was definitely a crazy, crazy time for us.
Sure.
And we persisted and did have in-person classes. And
okay.
There were a lot of protocols mm-hmm. over the past year. And we think that I'm sure we'll have a lot of protocol that's been changed.
Right.
We've all been so affected by this. It's a generational change. Like there's a whole first year of students who didn't have like the traditional college experience.
Right.
Just like there was at every college, right?
Yep.
They don't even know what they missed. They don't even know what they missed. Like we have a massive club organization, right? There's Operation Piece of Bread, Pastry Arts Club,
right?
Asia. None of that came, you know, like they're going to be like, when they come back, they're going to be like, oh my gosh, like this is so cool. And, and we'll be glad about that. But of course, you know, there's still precautions to heed.
Right.
And then an interesting thing, I think we've talking about this with a colleague, it's a real lesson for the food service industry, right?
Yeah.
Like what happened with what was the rate of flu in during the last year? Like the you know, common flu? None, like hardly any, right? And so we had screening protocols during COVID, and those students weren't allowed to come on campus, or faculty or staff, right?
Yeah.
Shouldn't we be doing that for flu, right? This is a the food service industry, because of the pandemic, is going through this, you know, self-observation. Like, how much should we be paying these people? Like,
yeah,
isn't it like all this? You know, a while ago, food service workers were like frontline workers, right?
Right. Yep.
And now in the U.S., they're like, oh, we can't raise a minimum wage. You know, that's not gonna. We can't afford that. I'm like. A year ago, you said people who worked at Burger King were frontline workers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now you don't want to give them a raise, right? And so same thing. People, you know, in the old days, pre-pandemic, come to work sick because they can't afford not to.
Yep.
Or because they get pressure, you gotta come, you can't.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And you fight through it there.
Yeah. And then a bunch of other people get sick. So it's a sea change, you know, like, why shouldn't we just continue to screen those people?
Right.
You know what? You have the flu, can't come to class. You know why? Because you get other people sick. Remember last year?
Yeah.
The benefit, hopefully, and I know we shouldn't be too self-assured, is that, you know, last year people were dying en masse.
Yeah.
Right. And we need to remember that that's still the case. If people get the flu, that's still terrible. And a lot of people die from the flu, right? So it's, you know, this generational thing about how we come together, whether it's in community ovens or in the food service industry, it might take a long time for us to change or maybe not. And, you know, my mother says, every cloud has a silver lining, you know, and COVID was a pretty big cloud, but whatever silver lining we can get might, you know, we should be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, well, thanks Richard for doing this. I really appreciate it. And thanks for.
No, thank you so much.
I've loved following what you do. And so it's so nice to spend some time with you and have a good chat for sure.
Well, I appreciate your time too. Thank you so much.
Well, that was a lot of fun. I got a lot out of the chat, and I especially enjoyed when we started talking about the students that he works with and their role in the food industry going forward, and you know, some of the challenges that you have when you're young and all of that. And I hope if you are a bakery owner that wants to recruit new staff, that this might inspire you or give you the confidence or give you the nudge to hire a grad from a school like Johnson & Wales or SAIT in Calgary, or, you know, someone with some formal training and work with them. You know, it's an investment for sure, but I think it's worth it. Okay. I'm so glad that you took the time to listen to the show this week. As you might know, this show is 100% listener supported. That's how I'm able to bring it to you every week. People go to riseuppod.com, click the support the show button, and leave, you know, a couple of bucks, a small donation, sometimes recurring, you know, every month. They buy me a coffee, so to speak. And together, that provides the funding that I can do these interviews, that I can do the editing, that I can post them up, that I can host the show for you, that kind of a thing. And every little bit makes a difference. It really does. So if you would like to become a supporter of the Rise Up podcast, just head to riseuppod.com, click the support the show button. It's really easy after that. And you can get on the rolls of my best friends as show supporters. And then while you're there, check out the archives where there's over 140 episodes of this show that you can listen to. And they're all there for you. And there's going to be another one next week. So until then, have a great week. Work hard. Stay safe. Enjoy September. Happy baking. Bye-bye.